our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the Joint Operations Room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them by blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now.
Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue. The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents.
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses. As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers. Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Cost of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN is a higher power. Still, the UN is created by some countries which have the right or the veto right, and it shows flexibility towards these countries. countries. There is simply no base on which these countries take responsibility.
The results of the war imposed by the U.S. on Afghanistan are the shocking numbers of 30% rise in food insecurity, 41% increase in children malnutrition and rising poverty, 1.5 million people left with disabilities and 2 million widows. Poverty, unemployment and poor medical conditions are considered only some of the results of 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Despite the fact that the war is over, people are still facing challenges due to the effects of that war. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans have been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
In Britain, there are signs that the National Health Service's inability to offer prompt care is creating a surge in people resorting to private healthcare. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Patients are paying up to £550 an hour to see private GPs amid frustration at the delays many face getting an appointment with a National Health Service family doctor. Growing number of paid-for GP services are opening up across Britain in the latest sign of how The National Health Service's inability to offer prompt care is creating a surge in people resorting to private health care. Clinics are wooing customers by offering short-notice consultations that involve seeing a doctor face-to-face or remotely, and they can last for much longer than the standard 10-minute NHS equivalent. Private GP services are one of the big growth areas of a burgeoning private healthcare sector, said David Hare, the chief executive of the Independent Healthcare Providers Network, a trade body. The London General Practice on Harley Street in central London had the highest fees among the 25 non-NHS GP providers that The Guardian looked at. It charges £275 for half an hour with a family doctor, £412 for 45 minutes with a family doctor, and £550 for an hour-long consultation. It rises to £348 for a 30-minute slot if it is out of hours or a bank holiday. A GP or general practitioner from the clinic will also do a house call for £500, £550 or £575, depending on the time of the day. Further along the street, synonymous with private medicine, another practice charges £220 for a half-hour appointment and £400 for the full-hour appointment. The number of patients accessing a private general practitioner GP is small compared with the 1 million a day in England who see an NHS family doctor. But it is growing fast as the National Health Service is struggling with a deepening shortage of full-time GPs at a time when demand for care is rising and some GPs are retiring due to burnout. For example, the insurance company AXA has seen a significant spike in demand for Doctor at Hand, its virtual-only family doctor service. The number of appointments provided by Doctor at Hand had tripled from 17,000 a month before the COVID pandemic to about 50,000 today, it said. Similarly, the number of appointments provided by GPs working for Spire Healthcare, the private hospital group, jumped from 23,000 in 2021 to 32,900 last year, a 43% increase. People enjoy the flexibility that private GP services offer, including the ability to book longer appointments at short notice, choose the location and format of the appointment, or they want to see the same GP with each appointment, said Dr. Cathy Cale, the company's group medical director. We believe this heightened demand for private GP services is here to stay as people prioritise their healthcare and want a service that suits their needs and supports an often busy lifestyle. Spire Healthcare's acquisition last December of the Doctors Clinic Group of non-NHS GP surgeries made it one of the biggest operators in that market and increased the number of GPs it employs to 128, up from 80 in 2020. It spent £12 million on the deal because of a significant rise in patients wanting to see a GP face-to-face. Private GPs' drive to attract paying customers is helped by the fact that they can refer a patient on to the National Health Service for any follow-up care they may need, such as a scan or to see a hospital specialist. Alan Johnson, the chief executive of the London General Practice, said the quality of its service justified its high prices. "We are proud of the personalised service and high-quality care that we provide, which goes above and beyond what other healthcare providers offer, including access to 30-minute same-day appointments, a medical personal assistant available to all the patients who can arrange access to onward diagnostics or consultant appointments often for the same day, and a 24/7 visiting service. In addition, the growth in the private GP practices poses a further challenge to the National Health Service because they're likely to be staffed by those GPs who are either exhausted from working within the National Health Service or are newly qualified doctors who are dissuaded from working for the NHS because it has been so badly funded by government over the last decade. This has the potential to create a downward spiral whereby the National Health Service loses GPs, which make primary care worse, which often causes more GPs to opt out and more middle-class patients to turn to private healthcare options. Professor Martin Marshall, an ex-chair of the Royal College of GPs, voiced his fear last year that the National Health Service GP services could over time go the same way as National Health Service dentistry, with dissatisfaction with the care on offer prompting better-off patients to go private. Patient satisfaction with the National Health Service has sunk to its lowest level amid unhappiness at waiting times for GP and hospital care. Professor Camilla Hawthorne, the Royal College of GPs chair, said she did not feel particularly threatened by the expansion of private GP services. For some people, it can be a useful add-on because the clinic is easy to access on their way to work or open at the weekends. The vast majority of people would probably not go private to see a GP. They would still go to their own family doctor rather than going to private healthcare. But of course, there are people who can afford to do that and who do that, she said. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Family doctors are demanding the right to charge their National Health Service patients for private appointments. It would allow wealthier patients to pay their GP to effectively jump the queue and potentially avoid the 8 a.m. scramble to be seen. But critics last night warned the two-tier healthcare system could lead to medics shunning those who cannot afford to pay, leaving them without access to healthcare. The Daily Mail reported that some patients were paying up to £550 an hour to see a private GP amid frustration at the delays many face getting an appointment with a National Health Service family doctor. Clinics are wooing customers by offering short-notice consultations, which involve seeing a doctor face-to-face or remotely. And they can last for much longer than the standard 10-minute National Health Service equivalent. It comes after dentists slashed the number of NHS treatments and consultations they delivered in order to prioritise their more lucrative private services. Elected GP representatives yesterday passed a motion calling for the introduction of private charges at the annual conference of UK Local Medical Committees, or LMCs. The statutory body represents individual GPs and practices as a whole, and its opinion helps shape British Medical Association policy and negotiations with the National Health Service England regarding GP contracts. The motion said, conference notes that unlike dentists and pharmacists, GPs cannot currently offer many private services to their National Health Service patients, and believes that GP surgeries should, at their discretion, be allowed to offer their NHS patients paid-for healthcare services if these services are routinely offered by the National Health Service but are not accessible in a time frame that the patient deems reasonable. Delegates also passed a motion saying general practitioners or GPs should be allowed to charge their NHS patients for services not routinely offered by the National Health Service, and that GPs should be trusted to manage potential conflicts of interest arising out of these changes. Some general practitioners, GPs, expressed concern about the policy worsening health inequalities and perpetuating a two-tier healthcare system, according to GP magazine Pulse. Dr. Jessica Randall Carrick said, This motion perpetuates the inverse care law. Those that have the least need for our services will demand it more, and those with more diseases, the more severe disease earlier in life, will be given whatever energy we have left over. Dr. Naomi Rankin said allowing general practitioners to offer paid-for services blurs the line between National Health Service and private healthcare and encourages a two-tier healthcare system.
Now from Ontario.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's Navy 86th flotilla has returned to the country after completing its eight-month mission of sailing around the world. Its 63,000-kilometer trip has broken the record for distance that an Iranian flotilla has sailed in international waters. Now, this despite many warnings and even military threats against Iran while taking on this task. Now, the Dana and Macron destroyers were Iranian-made, and all of this has been done while Iran has been and is under heavy economic sanctions. We'll talk about Iran's military achievements on the high seas and beyond on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, Shadia Razdi, political analyst. And out of Belgrade, John Busnes, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Shabir, let me start with you. Tell us about the significance of this flotilla and what it has accomplished.
Hello, good evening, Marzia. It's good to be back. Thank you very much.
Good to have you.
The significance is really not quantifiable, and you can't measure it, because at the same time as your opening comment said that Iran has been under multiple sanctions since its inception 43 years ago as an Islamic Republic. And the sanctions have been vicious. They have obviously inflicted immense pain on ordinary people, all kinds of restrictions. Having said that, any other nation, as I have previously pointed out, would have succumbed by now. But what has happened with the Islamic Republic of Iran, that it has really progressed leaps and bounds. And this particular flotilla sort of going round the globe in 8 months, and again, in your opening comments, it says lots of issues were involved, the difficulty for it to cross through the Panama Canal itself, all kinds of threats were made. But with the grace of God, it has actually come back from where it started. So it's an achievement that I think the Iranian nation should be immensely proud. And of course, what's happening globally with the North-South divide and, the meeting taking place of the so-called G7 in Hiroshima, it's obviously a signal to all these sort of powers in the West who have been trying to really muzzle Iran and really sort of put it on the sidelines, but it is developing and progressing in all manner and without any sort of support from the West, technologically, intellectually, militarily. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, at the end of the day, what the Western powers want is that nations should be weak militarily so that they can be dominated. Of course, they use other weapons, economic sanctions, you know, taking Iran out of the international banking system. But nonetheless, as I said, the word remarkable itself doesn't really sufficiently describe what this particular achievement is, okay, and overall achievement that has taken place militarily.
All right, Shabir, let me get John in on this discussion. I mean, John, you know, I'm old enough to remember back in the 80s, the Iraqi imposed war on Iran and how Iran was struggling to find military equipment, parts, anything they could. And basically the whole world basically told them no, that they wouldn't give them anything, or it was very difficult for them to get. I want to talk about from the 80s, now we fast forward to today, and we see the type of, whether we're talking about military equipment, we're talking about destroyers right now as far as the ships, and so many other type of equipment that Iran has been able to actually design and create themselves. Let's talk about the significance of this while under sanctions, major economic sanctions.
You know, there's a basic background here that that has gone past the Western media viewer. They're not aware of the size of the population of Iran. They don't realize that there are more people in Iran than there are in Turkey. They don't realize the historic past of the Persian Empire. They don't have the basic knowledge about the region to understand Iran's desire to be independent and to be free of Western colonial pressures. So this physical demonstration by the fleet is a re-entry, hopefully, of Iran as a world power in the minds of the people in the West, because the Western military alliance is basically a bully. And we all know that the one thing that scares a bully is a victim who stands up for himself. And that is what Iran has become. And this flotilla's movement across the globe, despite all pressures from America, is the best way to show them that their monopoly of power is over.
Hmm. Well, Shabir, the commander of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, said the naval forces on board the Dina and Macron showed up on the high seas to declare that the Islamic Republic is impervious to isolation and sanctions, and it continues to tread the path of sustainable development through the promotion of interaction with world nations. Your thoughts on this statement?
Well, look, it's very clear that, as our other panelist has quite rightly pointed out, that Iran is an immense power in West Asia now, without any doubt. It's not only that the population is larger than Turkey, but the population of Iran is larger than most of the Arab nations in that particular part of the world. And of course, the universities are doing their work. Intellectual capital is being built. I mean, some years ago, I was attending a conference in Tehran, and there were, you know, this is about 10 years ago, there were about 300 companies and universities and institutes that were doing research on nanotechnology. So it's not just military. At many, many levels, what Iran is trying to show is that it can be independent. It is not dependent on other nations. And really, you know, the so-called intellectual property that the Western companies and sort of universities try to sort of control the world is that Iran is creating its own intellectual property at many levels. As we know, the whole story of drones, how Iran has been successful in sort of manufacturing and exporting drones now to many parts of the world. At the same time, militarily, it's producing, all kinds of long-range missiles, which, of course, threaten Tel Aviv and so on. And Mr. Netanyahu only very recently said that, you know, 95% of the threat to Israel comes from Iran. So really, the Western powers and the nation, the Zionist state that has been created in West Asia, has been really trying to control, manage, and really, at the end of the day, to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran and so-called regime change. And that has been a perpetual game for the last 43 years. And, you know, internal issues have been created. As I said, economic warfare has been inflicted on the Islamic Republic of Iran, but it continues to progress. And that, I think, is the biggest threat.
Okay.
Because quite often when one talks about the JCPOA and the nuclear sort of treaty, but at the end of the day, that's, you know, as I've said previously, it's only a red herring. It's really what the West is worried about and concerned is that Iran is able to be strong enough militarily and produce its own sort of, you know, products which are originating in Iran itself.
Okay, Shabir. Well, John, just listening to what our other guest in London has said, and if you agree with him, he said that basically the U.S. would be afraid of an independent Iran. Let's talk about that. What does it mean? I mean, why would the United States, why should the United States be afraid of an independent country? Because, I mean, we see on this particular trip, around the world journey that these ships had taken, they were sanctioned by the U.S., and the U.S. also threatened any other country that would allow these ships to even dock in their countries. I mean, explain it. Go ahead, John.
Idle threats from America, which are not acted upon, are the best proof that America's star is fading. This is the proof. It has to be conducted in this way. You might recall that I've mentioned before that I spent the period of sanctions here in Serbia during the war that America and its allies ran against the former Yugoslavia. I've been on the receiving end of these sanctions. I know what they're like. Their effort is to turn the people against themselves. They ran a color revolution here and deposed the elected president. They took over the country, and we're still trying to recover from the American interference in this country some 20 years later. So I can tell you that we here in another country which has come under the pressure from America, we understand the value of the demonstration that Iran has made. And I can tell you that they are far more focused on emerging powers than they are on major powers like China or Russia, who they know they cannot destroy. So Iran is leading this third world new force of countries through BRICS and through other independent activities that are starting to say, America, no more. You're going to have to recognize our independence, or you will fall from any kind of relationship with the free and independent countries all around the world.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's talk about that, Shabir, which is what John just talked about with the emerging power of Iran, and he also mentioned China. Because what we have seen, a growing alliance between China, Russia, and Iran, and we have seen military maneuvers that have been done together. The significance of that, I mean, 20 years back, we go back 20 years, could you have envisioned this? And what does that mean for the United States?
Well, look, I will sort of just quote what our good friend Pepe Escobar recently wrote. And he said that the leadership of the West is in a sticky swamp of intellectual shallowness. And I think that really encapsulate what's going on, that they will wander here and there, have meetings, conferences. But the reality is that they're not able to sort of fathom the change that is taking place with the relationship developing with Russia, China, and Iran. It's a landmass in Asia. And obviously, they're working together on the economic front, on the banking front, and also sort of trading in their own currency. So the whole change that is occurring, and it's occurring at such a pace, and the velocity is so fast that I think the West are really unable to comprehend how it will pan out, let's say, you know, even the next 12 months to 24 months. And I think the West is losing its way if it hasn't already lost its way, because it's, you know, with the war in Ukraine, we can see that how the Europe is being completely depleted economically, intellectually, and militarily. And at the same time, they want to sort of take on China with the sort of Taiwan issue. And then, of course, sort of Iran is always being sort of, you know, seen as a nation which is, you know, from the Washington perspective, a sort of a troublemaker in the sort of West Asia. But what is happening is that we can see that with the Iran and Saudi sort of rapprochement taking place. And again, you know, Syria, Mr. President Assad being invited to the conference that took place recently in Riyadh. So you can see that there are huge movements and change that is taking place. And I don't think the West can keep pace and they can sort of continue to sort of apply more and more and more sanctions if they like. But the reality is that the you know, so-called Southern Hemisphere nations are now sort of collaborating more and more. And I think that's a sort of a good sign for the world at large.
Stay with me, Shabir. Well, John, it not only has Iran accomplished much on the seas, but militarily we see missile designs and launches or drones and lots of other military accomplishment. And as Shabir said, accomplishments in so many other fields also. But right now we're looking at the military aspect. That Iran has come a long way. I want to talk about, because this is really important, that what the United States does is threaten and sanction and puts enough pressure on countries where they feel that they cannot do anything else, where they have no choice. But despite all of this, Iran has been able to overcome that and advance technologically, exponentially. What's key here? What do you think was the key factor in order that Iran has reached where it has reached?
Well, let's step back a little bit. You mentioned that the Americans put sanctions where they can't do anything else, but actually they could always do something else. They could be a normal, non-aggressive democracy, as they claim to be. They could follow the advice and the instructions of George Washington, who in his farewell address told America not to become an empire like the one that they had defeated to win their independence. Everything that America is doing now is contrary to the basis of America's own statehood and to the wishes of the founding fathers, who tried not to make America what it has become today. And what has happened here is that America has become the enemy that it itself fought. Now we're looking at a situation where America, to maintain its own power, has actually knifed Germany in the back by putting Germany on the front line against Russia, by bombing the Germans' Nord Stream pipeline in the biggest eco-terror act in human history, and at the same time pretending to be Germany's friend while they occupy Germany militarily. This is a major error on America's part, and they are going to turn the EU against them, even though they created the EU to make them property of the United States.
Well, Shabir, the commander of Iran's navy has also said that the great sailing mission of the Iranian Navy's flotilla also confirmed that the U.S.-led liberal world order has been replaced by a multipolar world order, with new alliances being formed and emerging powers beginning to display their might. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's not only multipolar, but I would sort of quote here what Henry Kissinger has famously said, that, you know, it's dangerous to be an enemy of America, but it's fatal to be its friend. And that, I think, is becoming very clear, that
very
nations
true.
That have, you know, that nations that have regarded themselves to be friends of the USA, as our panelists quite rightly pointed out, Germany has been not only stabbed in the back, but it has been stabbed in the front, in the chest, very clearly. So, you know, it's becoming clear that nations that want to be independent, dignified, and honorable need to develop their own industries, have to stand up on their own feet, irrespective of sanctions, and create their own intellectual capital. Because one of the interesting things is that, you know, there was a story, I think, which was related a little while ago, that Malaysia, when they bought some sort of fighter bombers from America, they had some sort of chips embedded in it, which would sort of monitor exactly what their sort of you know, military planes were doing. So America does all kinds of things when they sell products, and particularly military products, to other nations, that they are either outdated or redundant, or in a way to be able to monitor and control those nations. So it's better that, you know, a nation like Iran is becoming self-reliant, resilient, and strong to be able to, you know, sort of produce its own military hardware, so that, because the other thing is, when you buy any military equipment, the European nations and America controls the supply of spare parts. And this happened at the beginning of the Islamic revolution in Iran, that, you know, most of its planes were not able to fly because they couldn't get the parts from America at that time. So why would a nation invest in its military hardware when parts will not be available 2 years down the road or 10 years down the road when they need it? So
okay,
it's good to have your own industry, and that's what I think Iran is doing admirably well.
All right, well, let me give John the last minute. John, your prognosis, where do you see this going as far as the Islamic Republic on the one hand, and then we have the United States on the other hand? Go ahead.
Speaking as a person born in the American colony of Canada, I can tell you that you've made some very wise moves. Canada developed an aircraft called the Avro Arrow, which was far more advanced than any American aircraft, and they shut down. The American government pressured the Canadian government to shut down our aircraft industry, and all of our engineers moved to NASA. I can tell you that independence is the only way to preserve sovereignty. Canada, with a population of 30 million, is an American colony and in name only a sovereign state. And you've seen the performance of our prime minister around the world. Mm. What Iran is doing is providing an example, not just to the countries which are allied with China and Russia, but to countries like my own native Canada, where intelligent people